Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the AI Business Podcast. I'm Ben Wodecki, and this is a really, really special episode for me anyway. I'd like to introduce Seth Dobrin, the founder and CEO of Quantum AI, former chief AI officer at IBM, and AI business tech columnist. Seth, it's an absolute pleasure to have you. Welcome.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here, Ben. Always love talking to you.
Thank you very much. That means an absolute, that means an awful lot, trust me. So Seth, today we're talking around asking questions around AI deployments. You're the right guy to understand that and talk about that. And you wrote something in November for us, and you came up with an interesting premise that companies should ask the right questions in AI deployments. Have they been asking wrong questions? What are the right questions to ask in your view?
Yeah, so I think let's go back to 2016 when I joined IBM 2017. And this whole thought process I had started way back then, and it hasn't really changed. When I joined IBM back then, you know, part of my job, big part of my job actually was, you know, I transformed a Fortune 500 company using data and AI, and they wanted me to share my experience, not just with IBM, but with IBM's customers. And so I spent the better part of the first 2 years literally flying around the world, you know, like 500,000 miles my first year there at IBM, not exaggerating too much, if at all. And what I found over the first year and a half, 2 years, was that companies were implementing AI or data science in a way that, and at the time I published an article, much to the chagrin of the marketing team at IBM, titled "Data Science is a Scam." And that's because the leaders and the companies were actually asking the question, how do I use AI? And not asking what I pose as the right question, which is, what are my strategic business objectives? And how does technology help me accelerate those or meet those? And inevitably, data and AI, and today Gen AI is going to be part of the solution. And so today when people call me up and say, hey, I need help implementing, you know, understanding how to implement Gen AI, I say, sure, I'll come help you. And then the first thing I do when I sit down and talk to the C-suite is, okay, that's the complete wrong question. The right question is, let's talk about your business strategy. What is your strategic objective? And in fact, what is your moat, right? What is your best defensible position? And actually, let's talk about your strategic objectives around that. And let's figure out how you use technology to shore up your moat and really accelerate that the strategic objectives around that defensible position.
So Seth, some of the people you've spoken to, you said you're helping them kind of devise and really improve their scenarios on this. Can you share with us any examples where actually they've got their strategic goals right at all?
Yeah, so I think there's a few companies. So, you know, so I think going back a ways, you know, there's some companies that, you know, have really focused their efforts on, you know, accelerating things that are core to their business. And let's look at you know, one of the, and this is a published example, one of the WPP businesses. So WPP is the largest media company in the world, media being, you know, marketing, advertising, that type of media. Wunderman Thompson Data, a number of years ago, had this massive data set that they had never been able to use. And Wunderman Thompson Data is a data company, right? Their whole objective is to have their customers come in and they would build custom marketing campaigns for them. And the custom marketing campaigns for them had really been only using a very small number of features or elements of data. And what they wanted to do was really to be able to use the entirety of the data set, which ended up being like 25,000 features or data elements from this data set. And so it went from being able to make, in quotes, custom marketing plans for every client that came in to truly being able to make custom, you know, marketing plans. And so this is an instance where, you know, Wunderman Thompson Data converted, you know, really, really amplified their strategic objective. In fact, it was their business model that they amplified around their moat, which was this massive data set that they were the only ones in the world that had it. And so that's a really good example. Another good example was my former company before I joined IBM, even Monsanto, where, you know, our moat was, you know, decades of agricultural data. So testing data from, you know, all the crops that we had grown, we had really good records of what was successful, what was unsuccessful. And we actually transformed the whole process of how you grow crops, whether they're GMO or conventionally grown crops, using molecular markers, so DNA markers, and data science or AI to really accelerate things like disease resistance, drought tolerance, things like that. So taking GMOs aside, regardless of what you think about them, really just accelerating the development of crops, and then also looking at yield. So accelerating yield using conventional breeding technologies. And again, accelerating the strategic objectives of the company, which is, you know, the strategic objective of Monsanto, you know, the North Star was to feed the world, right? But there were more real strategic objectives, which were improve yield, and to improve yield, it's crop, you know, disease resistance, overall yield, drought resistance, things like that. Those are two examples that I can talk about where actually named companies.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I must admit, it's scary how incredible farming and agriculture is now compared to when my grandfather was doing it. It's always terrifying. Seth, I want to go just delve into that a little bit deeper. How you've talked about those examples, talk us through step by step how they would align that with the business goals. Is it specific for each company, or do you have to kind of set it up as a blanket? What's your kind of view on that?
Yeah. And so, you know, that is exactly, so that whole process is what Quantum AI is built around. And over the course of the last, so I started doing that in 2006. So building this whole construct of how I do that. So pretty much for almost the last two decades. So 18 years, I've been honing this strategy or this approach to a strategy. It really starts with sitting down with the C-suite in an ideal case. And what are your core business objectives? So what is your North Star? What are your core business objectives? And then understanding what it is, how is technology going to really help accelerate those? So taking the business objectives, looking at the current state of technology, and which of those business objectives can technology help accelerate? And building out a plan at a very, very high level of where we want to focus the technology. And then the next level is going down with the lines of business. So the line of business leader that sits in the C-suite, going with her team, and sitting down and understanding what are the use cases that are going to help her accelerate those business objectives, and then mapping out those use cases and setting up the place for the actual data science teams to then take those and execute. And you actually also line those use case to KPIs that matter to the business. The C-suite doesn't care how many models you have. The C-suite doesn't care how much data is getting, you know, doesn't care about your recall or your precision. They care about how much money you're saving, how much money you're making, and maybe cost avoidance in some cases, right? So those are your KPIs, and they need to be done in agreement with the CFO so that when they roll up, they really matter. And so, yes, you need those other KPIs down on the ground, but at the C-suite level, at the, you know, C-suite minus one, maybe minus two level, those financial KPIs are really, really what's needed. And that's the strategy you take to align that. There's some other pieces that also get involved with that. One is AI governance. So what are the policies, controls, and frameworks that are needed in order to enable that? So how do you make sure that when the teams are building those, they understand what are the guardrails for your organization? So what's inbounds, what's out of bounds? And AI governance done right actually does not inhibit innovation. It accelerates it because it focuses within your organization where people can innovate. And so that's where they spend their time innovating instead of doing things that are not going to be able to be put in production. And then, of course, education. And education needs to happen from the mailroom to the boardroom. Everyone needs to understand, especially in today's day and age with generative AI, how generative AI or AI in general, what it is, how it can be used, and how it's potentially going to impact them.
I want to just gauge, Seth, around the C-suite involvement, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, there is this hype and there are these companies that are going, we need this. But would you say the C-suite are more engaging now, considering, you know, they're interested in this? Or is it, you know, are they looking at it from a business case? How are you kind of finding their involvement now compared to, say, 2 years ago?
Yeah, so I think yes and no. So I think it's kind of spotty. So I think in private companies, particularly in private equity owned companies, there's a lot of focus at the C-suite level on this, and that's driven by the private equity firms because they have a lot at stake, right? They're expecting a certain amount of return. There's risk, you know, there's potential risk to their investment. And so they want to understand the risk and they want to address that risk head on. And so there are conversations that are being mandated by some private equity firms at the C-suite and even at the board level of these companies, you know, medium to large companies, not Fortune 500 companies, for the most part, that are happening, you know, at those companies. There are a few public companies that are having these conversations. You know, I would say a small number of Fortune 500 companies are having these conversations at the board level. And then the smaller public companies are starting to as well. So I've gotten, you know, some inquiries about board seats and, you know, and C-suite conversations at some smaller public companies. But for the most part, if you look at these Fortune 500 companies, you know, those conversations are not really happening. And this needs to be taken as seriously as cybersecurity, right? And it's not. And in the US, so in Europe, there is requirements that boards are evaluated, that they're actually their people are on boards for a reason. In the US, there's not that requirement. And a lot of times boards are there for cronyism. There's customers on boards. They really don't add value. Aside from kind of quid pro quo, you're on my board, I'm on your board, you know, you're a big customer, we want to keep you close. That's value, but it's not the right kind of value to running, in my mind, to running a company. And so they're not really bringing people onto boards that understand AI or data that are going to push the C-suite to really have these conversations and challenge the C-suite in this area.
So I'd like to pick up, Seth, on the smaller aspect in the smaller companies you mentioned, because in one of your earlier columns, you said that, you know, we're focusing on the big guys, you know, Microsoft's people like that. But actually, how does it come into play when, you know, SMEs are wanting to get involved? You mentioned it briefly there, but are there any wider considerations for these smaller firms? Is it, you know, more a case of, you know, talking to them about open source? What's your kind of take on that?
Yeah. So the SMBs, so the small, medium sized businesses have a cost challenge. It's a cost and a challenge problem, right? These models are not cheap to run. Talent is expensive. It's scarce. And so, you know, I think that's, there's a big challenge there for them that they really need to think about. Again, one with the smaller equity owned firms, there's an advantage that they have, which is part of why they're doing that, is the equity firms can choose to put money into them to help fund these, right? And so if there's a big risk, they can put more VC backed companies, the same thing. Those investors can choose to put more money in it to mitigate their risk if they can turn that risk into a big opportunity, right? So they have, again, they have an advantage that a privately held, you know, an individual held or partnership held, you know, SMB, small, medium-sized business doesn't have. But there are some ways to get around that, right? There are some commodity tools that you can use. So, I think even open source, there, you know, that, yes, it's quote unquote free, but open source is not free. Open source has never been free. There's a lot of support costs with it. There's compute costs with it. Almost inevitably, you are not going to run your open source models as efficiently or effectively as, you know, Microsoft or Google or, you know, one of those companies are. And so it's going to cost you more to run it than it probably would be for you to just buy the license. And so the reason to run open source is not cost, just like the reason to run cloud is not cost, because it's not cheaper. And so, you know, I think SMBs need to look at commodity tools. They need to focus on challenges that they can buy off the shelf. There are, you know, addressing challenges that they can buy off the shelf, and then build on top of those, add their own IP into those. But they need to obviously make sure that there's a couple things they need to ensure about. One is when they add their data, it stays proprietary to them, especially in smaller niche industries. because their data is their IP and it's their differentiator. The other thing that I always tell companies when they're looking at these tools is that, you know, there's a lot of risk that's based into these tools today. There's a lot of unknowns around regulations, right? The UK just declared yesterday that their, you know, copyright still applies, right? These companies that are training these models, they have to respect copyrights, right? That was unknown until 2 days ago, right? What the UK position was going to be on that. So there's a lot of risk that's in the, a lot of unknown risk that's in these models. So companies need to make sure that they are indemnified. So if you're buying a model from or a tool from some startup that's using a custom model or an open source model, are they indemnifying you against it? If not, I wouldn't touch it. It's worth the extra cost to go to one of the bigger players. As much as I like supporting startups, and I try to whenever I can, if they're not indemnifying my business and it's a core part of my business, I'm going to be really hesitant about using it because I don't want to inherit any of that risk should, you know, there be some fine, because, you know, you don't know. We don't know what that looks like. Are these government, are these regulators going to come after people that are using these tools, especially if you're doing business in the EU or in the UK, where there are some, you know, and you're in a high risk area, you're doing something around human resources, you're doing something around finance or healthcare. There's some big risks there that I would really, really want to be indemnified against if I'm using a commodity tool.
So on that, is there anything open source that you're interested in terms of, you know, adopting this? I've been writing about a couple of benchmark tests, but I'm keen to figure out, is there anything that's maybe caught your eye, even if it's a case of, you know, that could be good with a few more, you know, tweaks and safety precautions maybe?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are some open source, there's a couple things to your point about benchmarks. So there are some benchmarks that you want to keep an eye on, and there are some open source models that you want to keep an eye on. And I think let's define open source. And so, especially in generative AI, there's open source and there's pseudo open source. So the only two truly open source models are Bloom and Falcon, because they open source the model and the data. So you can go in and inspect the data and understand the data that's in there, which minimizes your risk because you can make decisions about that. And you can look at the data and say, okay, you can have your legal team, your privacy team evaluate the data, however cumbersome that will be, right? It's big data sets. But you could do it if you wanted to. So those two are truly open source, right? Meta made this big announcement about their models that they're going to open source them. But they're not, plus those two, you have free license to use it, period. Plus, you know, with Meta, that's a pseudo open source because yes, you can use it up to a certain amount of usage. Once you make a certain amount of money, you have to pay them. But on top of that, their data is not open source. And so they are not giving you access to their data set. So you can't make evaluations of the risks that you're inheriting in those models. In terms of benchmarks, so I think there's two benchmarks you want to keep an eye on. And both of those benchmarks are from private companies. So one is the Hugging Face benchmark, and that looks at performance of these models. The other benchmark just came out a couple of weeks ago, and that's from a company called Galileo. And they published a hallucination index. And hallucination, for those of your listeners who aren't knee deep in this, is when these models make stuff up. It's when the models lie, right? So, you know, they don't understand the context. It really stems from a few things, but, you know, to completely overgeneralize it, they weren't trained on enough of the data and you didn't ask the question specifically enough for it to answer the question right. So it just made something up. And so think of it as a 20-year-old man who is a know-it-all. And so it just, you know, completely felt like it had to answer the question. So it did when it should have said, I don't know. Right. And so, you know, Galileo created a hallucination index. And so they've actually ranked hallucination. And the good thing about it is not only did they rank the models, but there's some methods that have been developed that were developed specifically to reduce hallucinations. And they also have a hallucination index. They measured these hallucination index looking at how much those methodologies reduced hallucinations, right? So one is called RAG, or retrieval augmented generation. Sorry, for some reason I lost that for a second. So RAG stands for retrieval augmented generation. What that means is you're limiting the responses to a specific set of content that you provide. And so even if that hallucinates, it's going to hallucinate based on your content. So that's better than just general hallucinations. And then the other one is long form prompting. So really asking very, very long questions that help focus the questions. The problem is you ask too long questions, that confuses the model too. It actually forgets part of your questions. So the other problem with these around hallucinations is that there was a paper published last spring that showed when you ask for references, 42% of the references have nothing to do with the response. So they're completely off the wall. And another 40, I'm getting the numbers wrong, but another 40 some odd percent, while they have something to do with the topic, they're wrong. And basically the numbers add up to is like 6% of the time you get a completely accurate reference. Granted, this is almost a year old at this point, but you have to be careful even when you ask for references because they're not correct. My anecdotal experience today is it's still not good because I still use it. I still ask for references. A lot of them are still completely wrong. A lot of them are still completely off the wall, even when they're quote unquote right. So, there's some core problems. And so the other part of your question besides the index, I went a little bit tangential there. What model? So I think I'm very excited about the Falcon models. I think those are really interesting. Those were built from an institute called TII in the UAE. Those are the open source models, truly open source, which is why I'm excited about them. Plus, they perform well on the Hugging Face index. I'm also excited about the Gemini models that came out from Google, because they're the first truly multimodal model, meaning they're trained on multiple types of generative AI. So when we talk about language, video, audio, images, each of those is a mode in this. And so the Google models are trained on all of those together. Whereas if you look at ChatGPT, they brought different modes together. Yes, you can use the different modes in ChatGPT together, but they brought them individual models together in one. It's not really multimodal, so it's not as effective or efficient as Google's Gemini is. So those are the two I'm most excited about.
Thanks, Seth. I mean, more come out all the time, so I'm sure there'll be even more to really dig in.
Yeah. Actually, there was a paper published last month by Apple that's super exciting too, where they're looking to make these models really, really small so they can run on your phone, right? And so taking some of this incredible power that they have and slimming them back once they're trained so they can run on your phone. And I wear hearing aids, so people see me on keynotes and stuff. They're not AirPod, AirBuds I'm wearing. They're hearing aids. Even making them small enough so they can run on hearing devices, right? And so imagine being able to do language translation directly in a pair of hearing devices, right? So that's going to be possible in the near future from things like that. That's very exciting.
No, I am incredibly excited by. I saw someone call them SLM, small language models, and it looked wrong to me. But I am really excited about this. That's a whole nother podcast. Come on, Seth. I want to talk about what's to come, because you wrote a fantastic piece at the turn of the year for us around reminiscing around the craziest of 2023 and the Gen AI wave. And I'm keen to kind of see how you think the business side of things are going to change. 6 months when we meet in London, and then the next 12 months, what are you seeing? What are you expecting, frankly?
Yeah, so I think let's start with the technology. So from a technology perspective, I think 2024 is going to be a year of verticalization. So you're seeing all this investment in chips, right? So if you look back to compute, we went from specialized compute to generalized compute to specialized compute, looking at GPUs. And now we're going to get to very specialized compute, where each of these companies that are building their models are going to have their own specific architecture, not just for specific types of generative AI or foundation models. So foundation model, generative AI is a type of foundational model. Foundation model is a type of pre-trained deep learning model. So they're each going to have their own chip architecture for their foundation models, which will do a few things. So one, it will make them more performant. It will make them more energy efficient because they'll be more performant. So you're going to see, which will reduce the overall cost of training, of running them, it'll reduce the environmental footprint. So, you know, a few months ago also, there was a paper that said, you know, on the extreme side, for every 20 prompts you do in ChatGPT, you use a half a liter of water, right? That's mind-boggling, right? Considering how many users use this thing. And so how do they reduce that, you know, aside from, you know, not greenwashing and going to true green compute, how do they reduce that on top of that? And that doesn't even consider the training. So that's one thing, a complete verticalization of the stack, just like you see with the iPhone, where they make everything, and that makes it much more efficient. Smaller models, like we just talked about. So we're going to see we're going to see big models being trained and then them being made small, which is what Apple paper published. We're also going to see more multimodal models being developed this year. So truly multimodal models. So being trained from the ground up. So Google released Gemini, as I said. I imagine that we'll see such from Facebook, from Meta. They have a lot of data that they could train multimodal data from Facebook, from Instagram, right, from all of their properties. I imagine TII will put something out. I imagine OpenAI is going to update. I imagine GPT-5 or whatever is going to come out next will be truly multimodal. And so I think those are going to be the big things that are going to happen between now and AI Summit in June in London. And so that's not a long time from now. So I think in the next 6 months, you're going to see those three things happen. Remember, this field is moving in a week. You're seeing advancements in a week, the rate that you were seeing in a year 10 years ago in cloud. So it sounds absurd when I say you're going to see those kinds of things happening in 6 months, but you're going to see those things happening in 6 months. Now, you may not have these models running on new chip architectures across all of those companies. Some of them you will. Google, almost guaranteed you'll see it running on a new chip architecture. I'm sure they're going to take their TPUs, their tensor processing units, and they're going to convert those. NVIDIA is building specific ones. So that's a lot in 6 months. The 6 months after that, we're going to see new types of generative AI models, right? This current architecture of these models is not sustainable, is not ideal for other types of problems. And so I think we'll see new types of generative AI. There's this whole concept of agent-based generative AI, which is kind of, you know, imagine a bunch of humans trying to generate stuff and solving a problem. And so you're creating a bunch of different personas working together. So think of that as a bunch of language models all trained on different things, generating a bunch of content, arguing with each other about what the best content is. So that's another complete overgeneralization about what it is. Then there's this whole other field called neurosymbolic learning, which is where AI truly reasons. There's the opportunity to combine that with generative AI, which is where this will allow you to focus these learnings, these generative AI, the training of these generative AI models, and the inferencing or the using of these generative AI models, focusing them in a way that helps minimize some of these issues. So the other thing that I hope we start talking about this year is this whole concept of technological colonialism. There's a lot of talk about addressing bias specifically, and that this is just one part of technological colonialism in these models, right? And the whole construct of bias is a social construct. Now, I think globally, we can agree for the most part that we want to worry about gender bias. And so when we look at gender bias, this concept of that I'm talking about technological colonialism doesn't exist. When we start talking about other types of biases, specifically since these models are primarily being built in China and the West, if we start addressing bias in these pre-trained models, so any foundation model, which is a pre-trained deep learning model, if we start addressing bias in these models, we are essentially inflicting our social ideals on the rest of the world, specifically those south of the equator. And so we are then forcing them to adopt our social constructs of bias, which don't necessarily impact them, and ignoring their social constructs of bias. And so we need to make sure that they are involved in the development of these models. They are involved in the definition of bias. And maybe we need to rethink if we want to control bias in these models, or we want to look at something called disparate impact, which is where you actually address disparate, so negative impacts in the outcomes, right? So do we really care if the model is biased, or do we really care if the output of the model is biased? I don't think we care if the model is biased. I think we care if the output is biased. And so I think that's an important distinction that we need to think about, that you know, we often don't. We focus on the model, and really, really, we don't care what's in the model. We care what's in the output. The other aspect of this is the socioeconomic difference, right? These models, this AI, as impactful as it is, it has the opportunity to accelerate divides between the haves and the have-nots, whether it's the global digital divide between essentially north of the equator and south of the equator, or it's a socioeconomical divides within society. And this technology can either help minimize those if we include these people in the development and use of these technologies, or it's going to create a whole lot of social strife and further divide these communities. And so we need to be very mindful about how we address this whole issue of technological colonialism very deliberately, and it needs to be part of the conversation today.
Thanks, Seth. I really appreciate you talking about that, because it's not something that is said with such frankness sometimes in this industry, and it's always great. You talked about it last year in London, and I'm glad that I'm looking forward to hearing more about it this year, because it's just something that they kind of gloss over it a little bit sometimes. It's more just, we're dealing with bias, and then it's, you know, onto, oh, look what it can do. And, you know, there's not a lot of frankness, so I'm appreciative of that. Seth, it's been an absolute pleasure having you. We always love talking to you, and we're very appreciative of your time. For our audience, please go and check out his AI IQ column, which is at the moment is the crazy one on 2023. Please go and read it. It's fantastic. Seth, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure chatting with you as well, Ben. Always fun talking with you, and we'll catch up again.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.